out over the upmost edge of the caprock. Go out to your land. Tell people you're going to raise cattle. Walk along the upper areas until you find a spring. Calculate how high above sea level you are, and then walk back and forth along that elevation. If you find half a dozen more springs, it's not even a gamble, Mr. Hawksworth, because then you know the water's hiding down below you. You come out and check, Whip suggested. People might guess, then land values go up. Whip reflected on this shrewd observation and made a quick decision. Buy yourself a good bull. Bring him to the islands with you, and we'll announce that you're going to help me raise cattle. Then everybody'll feel sorry for me, because lots of people have gone bust trying that on the barren lands. Takes 20 of our acres to support one cow, and nobody makes money. 3 weeks later, little Mr. Overpeck arrived in Honolulu with a bull and announced to the Honolulu Mail that he was going to advise Mr. Whipple Hawksworth in the raising of cattle on the latter's big ranch west of the city. He led his bull out to the vast, arid, useless acres, and as soon as he got there, he told Whip, "Buy that land over there for me." And Whip did, for practically nothing. And the next day he concluded that he had been victimized by the shrewd little man, for they tramped both Whip's acres and Overpeck's, and there were no springs. "Why the hell did you bother me with your nonsense?" the young man railed. "I didn't expect any springs today," Overpeck said calmly. "But I know where they'll crop out after the next big storm up in the mountains." And sure enough, 3 days after the rain clouds left, along the line that Overpeck had predicted, he and Whip discovered sure evidences of seepage. They stood on the hillside, looking down over the bleak and barren acres, Whip's 4,000 and Overpeck's 1. And the little man said, "We're standing on a gold mine, Mr. Hawksworth. I'm mortally certain there's water below. Buy up all the land you can afford." 8 weeks later, the little man reappeared in Hawaii without any cattle, but with 9 large boxes of gear. This time he informed the mail, "It looks as if Mr. Hawksworth's investment in cattle is going to be lost unless somehow we can find water on those acres." He set up a pyramidal wooden derrick about 12 feet high, at the bottom of which were slung 2 large iron wheels connected by an axle upon which rope could be wound when the wheels were turned by hand. This rope went from the axle and up to the top of the derrick, where it crossed on a pulley and dropped down to be lashed to the end of a heavy iron drill. Laboriously, Overpeck cranked the heavy wheels until the iron drill was hauled to the top of the derrick. Then he tripped a catch and jumped back as the drill plunged downward, biting its way through sand and rock. Laboriously, he turned the wheels and lifted the drill back into position. Then a swift whir, and the next bite was taken. "How long will this take?" Hawksworth asked, amazed at the effort required. "A long time. Have you the strength?" "I'm boring for $1 million," the wiry little man replied. "I got the strength." Days passed, and weeks, and the determined engineer kept hoisting his drills, breaking their points on almost impenetrable hard pan, sharpening them by hand, and hoisting them once more. "You ought to have an engine," Whip growled as the work made slow progress. "When I get some money, I'll get an engine," Overpeck snapped. Now Whip saw the little fighter in a new light. "All your life you've been broke, haven't you?" "Yep. All my life I was waiting for a man like you." "Are we going to hit water?" "Yep." At 200 feet, the drills were hammering their way through caprock, once soft ocean mud, but now, millions of years later, rock as hard as diamonds. Whip grew despondent and was afraid to pass through the streets of Honolulu, where people already hated him for the way he had treated his former wife, Iliki Janders, and where they now laughed at him for his folly in trying to raise cattle on his barren acres. At first, when those who had sold additional land saw Overpeck's drilling rig, there had been consternation. "Has Whip bamboozled us? Did he know there was water below that rubble? Such fears relaxed when it was apparent that no water existed. He's down to 250 feet and is running out of rope, spies reported. And then, on the 14th of September, 1881, Milton Overpeck's plunging drill crashed through the last 2 inches of caprock, and up past the iron, past the rope, gushed cold, sweet water at the rate of 1,300,000 gallons a day. When it gurgled to the top of the well, it kept rising until it reached the apex of the 12-foot derrick and stood a steady 14 feet in the air, hour after hour, month after month. When Whip saw the glorious sight, he became agitated and cried, "We must save that water." But little Mr. Overpeck assured him, "Son, it'll run forever." They scooped out a large depression in which the water was impounded and then pumped to wherever it was needed. They drilled additional wells, all by hand, and Whip said, "Overpeck, it's ridiculous for you to do so much work. Let's buy an engine that'll do it for you." But the determined little man replied, "I finish these wells, I'm never going to work again. I'm going to get a hotel room, lease my land to you, and live easy." He did all these things, but he had failed to anticipate the natural future of a man like Overpeck in Hawaii. One of the unmarried Janders girls smelled him out, checked the land records to be sure he owned the land he said he did, and married him. Thus, his 1,000 acres was brought safely back into the grand alliance of Hawksworth, Whipple, Hale, Janders, Hewlett. Whip worked like a maniac organizing his own acres, now 6,000, plus the 1,000 he leased from Overpeck, and by means of pumps and ditches brought water to all of it. He bought out the old Malama sugar plantation and transferred its name and operation to his new lands. Then, with the touch of genius that characterized his business dealings, at the age of 26, he turned the entire management of his sugar lands over to Janders and Whipple, and he set out to see more of the world. In late 1883, he returned to Honolulu with a cargo of new orange trees from Malaya, some excellent coffee beans from Brazil, the amazing torch ginger flower, a red slashing thing, and a tall, dark Spanish wife, Aloma Duarte Hawksworth, who quickly bore him a son whom she insisted upon calling Jesus Duarte Hawksworth, and whom Honolulu called J.D., derived from his initials. Aloma Hawksworth was a sensation in the islands, for she was by nature an exotic creature, and she quickly announced to her husband that his days of roistering on Rat Alley were ended. But it was easier for her to issue such instructions than to enforce them. So one night when Whip came home from delightful hours with the Chinese prostitute, Aloma Duarte tried to carve him up with a long knife. She gashed him badly across the scar in his left cheek. But before she could strike again, he kicked her in the stomach, knocked her breathless against the wall, and proceeded to break her jaw and wrist. "No one comes at me with a knife," he explained publicly. And when the once beautiful woman was mended, she decided to bring brutality charges against him in the Honolulu courts. But against her stood the mute testimony of the jagged gash in Wild Whip's cheek, and her lawyers advised her to drop charges. When she did so, Micah Hale, Bromley Hewlett, and Mark Whipple visited her and advised her that they were ready to provide her with a small but adequate annuity if she would agree to leave the islands. "There's no place for you here," Micah explained. "I'm taking J.D. with me," she threatened. "Whip won't allow that," her father-in-law warned. "J.D. is for me," Aloma Duarte stormed. "He belongs in the islands," Micah reasoned with her, and in the end, she left exactly as the family had originally planned, with exactly the annuity they had suggested. In New York, she told a friend, "I was more afraid of the three bearded ones than I was of my husband. He comes at you with his fists, but they soft-talk you to death. In Hawaii, they run things pretty much their own way, but they were generous." And west of Honolulu, the once barren lowlands that had formerly required 20 acres to nourish a cow, blossomed into the lushest, most profitable agricultural lands in the world. When the sugar cane stood 8 feet tall, bursting with juice, for mile after mile you could not see the red volcanic soil, nor could you see the water that Wild Whip had brought to it. All you could see was money. In 1885, Nyuk Tsin could no longer postpone decision about her sons, and as she studied Ah Chow, Ao Chow, Fei Chow, Mei Chow, and O Chow, she realized both how difficult her job was going to be and how important. At Iolani, the Church of England school, she was giving the boys the best education available to them on the islands. Had they been able to get into Punahou, they would have learned more and would have associated with the missionary children who were destined to rule Hawaii. But for both financial and social reasons, entry there was forbidden, and they had done well at the second-rate school. But now, the older boys were ready for advanced education, and it was clear that each merited college and university. They were bright boys, well-behaved, industrious, and alert. Their pigtails were well-tended, and they had learned to keep their nails clean. They had good teeth and clear skins. They were reasonably good at games and spoke 4 languages with skill, Puti, Hakka, Hawaiian, and English. Each was above high school ability in mathematics and abstract reasoning. And to choose among them the boy on whose shoulders the entire burden of the family should fall was difficult indeed. Nyuk Tsin was confused as to which of her boys ought to go to America, nor could she decide what he ought to study when he got there. In early 1885, therefore, she began her long inquiry, starting with Uliassutai Karakoram Blake, and he wasn't of much help because he vigorously espoused 2 directly conflicting criteria. As an Englishman, he swore, "No boy is worth educating unless he's proved himself good at games. Europe is the one. He has spirit and quickness of hand. He looks you in the eye when he gives you an answer. Fine, clean-cut lad to be trusted. Grow up to be a substantial man." That much was easy to understand, but when Uliassutai had said that, sort of in deference to British tradition, he promptly added, "But of course, England's the only place in the world where a man can get ahead simply because he has good character and the brain of an ass. Everywhere else you have to have intelligence. And let's face up to it, Wu Chow's auntie. Your son Europe is an ass, and I'm afraid that's done it. The only one who shows the quick intelligence required in a scholar is America. But he's so appalling at games I can never take him seriously. Probably turn out to be a pretty poor sort in the end, a thinker and all that. I'd never waste me money on him. But in France, he'd likely end up in the cabinet." Nyuk Tsin pretty well agreed with Uliassutai in his analysis of the 2 boys. Europe was going to make friends wherever he went, and was a fine, congenial boy. Not too good at books, but an admirable son. America was clearly the ablest, but he had a shy, withdrawing quality that sometimes frightened her. She concluded that what Blake was saying in his cryptic way was that he could not make the final choice. Apikela and Kimo were certainly not obscure. "The only one is Australia," they said firmly. "He speaks such good Hawaiian he sounds educated already." When Nyuk Tsin tried to press them on things like character, ability to work, or insight in business, they gave a quick, easy answer. "Only one's Australia. When he sings a song, you can hear the words so beautifully." Nyuk Tsin pointed out, "You 2 are with the boys more than I am. What do you see in them?" And again the answer was direct. "Australia is the one who will lead a happy life, because he has such a handsome smile and he knows how to laugh." Whenever the boy visited the Key House, slipping away from his Hawaiian parents, Nyuk Tsin would hear him joking with Kimo and Apikela, and once when she said to him, "Maybe you will go to America for your education," he had replied, I like it here. His friends were divided into four almost equal groups, Punti, Hakka, Hawaiians, and Haoles. At Iolani, he was elected president of his class and sang in the glee club. Then you would send Australia to college? Nyuktsin pressed. And Big Apikela replied, Oh, yes, he'd have a lot of fun at college. Nyuktsin pointed out, But we're sending him to study. And the Hawaiians laughed, Give him just as much as his tired little head will take and forget the rest. The Chinese community was again fairly clear in its recommendation. Partly because Asia was the oldest son and therefore to be respected, unless he proved himself inadequate, but mainly because he had already opened a restaurant on Hotel Street that did a good business, he was their overwhelming choice. The Punti said, This boy can be trusted. He buys wisely and sells with intelligence. At 19, he's already a better businessman than my son at 25. I wish he were my boy. The Hakka told Nyuktsin, We have watched your boys for some years, and the others sometimes seem more Hawaiian than Chinese. But Asia is different. He has a real Chinese understanding, and he will do well. Few Chinese deviated from this strong recommendation. And when Nyuktsin arranged a marriage for him with a Punti wife whose father owned land, he built himself even more solidly into the Chinese community. Asia Ki was bound to become a powerful man. That left Africa, the middle son. He excelled neither in games nor in books, nor was he inclined toward business or singing. His face was rather squarish, and unlike his brothers, he wore his pigtail tied at the end in a blunt knot. He would fight anyone who got in his way, but he was not offensively aggressive. His principal characteristic was hesitancy in making up his mind, accompanied by a bulldog tenacity when he had done so. His personal affections were kept well masked. He had no special regard for either Uliasutai Blake, Apikela, or Wu Chao's auntie. He studied each of them and knew their strengths, but not their love. His brothers rarely shouted to him to join them in a game, but they often asked him the schedule for the next day's lesson. His mother studied him with a good deal of care and concluded, In his stubborn, square-faced way, Africa is deeper than the others. She had almost as much trouble trying to decide what the chosen son should study if he got to America. Here, Uliasutai Blake was clear-cut in his advice. The world is run by those who can manipulate Wu Chao's auntie. There are only two decent vocations open to a man of talent. He should become a messiah and lead us into eternal darkness, or he should study to be a lawyer, and then God alone knows what he may accomplish. If I were a lawyer, I would run for parliament. If your son becomes a lawyer, he will coach you in how to cheat the government, and heaven knows that's to be learned by all of us. Lawyer, Wu Chao's auntie, nothing less. When she asked him, Who would make the best lawyer? He replied without equivocation, America. She thought the same. Kibo and Apikela were of no help. They pondered the problem for a long time, their great brown bodies wrestling with strange ideas. And finally Kibo asked, Why should fine boys like this be anything? Asia has a restaurant. Europe has a store. Australia has more friends than anyone in school. They like Hawaii. They fit in. Why bother them with all these big ideas? Nyuktsin, who appreciated the insight of these huge friends, asked, But which do you like better, a lawyer or a doctor or a dentist? The two Hawaiians studied this for some time and replied, For a Hawaiian, a lawyer is better, because he makes such wonderful speeches. But for a Pake, maybe a doctor is better, because he makes so much money. The Chinese community was more practical. The Punti, almost to a man, advised medicine. A doctor is always respected. He gets paid. He becomes a leading man in the city. And we need Chinese doctors. The Hakka pointed out, It takes 2 more years to become a doctor. Leave that to the Howleys. Your boy should be a dentist. Quicker, and in the long run, just as much money. One hot July day in 1885, Nyuk-tsin was hurrying down to Uwanu, her 2 baskets of pineapples balancing on her carrying pole, the way conflicting advice balanced in her mind, and she was thinking of lawyer versus doctor and Asia versus America, when 2 horses, pulling a J&W dray, reared in the air, dashed down Hotel Street, and threw their wagon against one of the poles that held up the roof of Asia Key's Chinese restaurant. The first pole snapped off, and the sudden weight thrown upon the second caused it to collapse, allowing the roof to fall into Hotel Street. No one was hurt, and a Hawaiian caught the reins of the runaway horses and easily brought them to rest. Asia, who was inside the restaurant, exploded onto the street, shouting curses at the horses who had so unexpectedly plunged his dining room into chaos. Nyuk-tsin hurried up, adding to the confusion by shouting, "I saw them! I saw them!" And the Hawaiian policeman agitated everyone by roaring, "Don't bring those horses back this way! Turn them around and get them out of here!" When the beasts reared, he bellowed, "Turn them around!" A man from J&W hurried up to assure everyone that the driver was at fault because he had stopped to watch a pool game and was going to be fired. And then, amidst the confusion, Nyuk-tsin, herself in great agitation, saw her son Africa, who had been helping wash dishes at his brother's restaurant, moving among the crowd and quietening the Chinese. "All right, Wu Chow's auntie," he said forcefully. "No more shouting. Nobody's hurt. Did you see what happened? Where were you standing?" And while the policeman fought with the man who had caught the horses, making him turn them around lest they stampede again, Africa Key quietly got the names of all who had witnessed the accident. "The driver was nowhere to be seen?" he asked repeatedly. "You saw the wagon hit the pole?" By the time Africa reached the J&W man, the latter's story about the drivers having been in a pool room had been changed. It was now quite a different story. But Africa had the names of everyone who had heard the first version. The extent of the damage was not great, and the cash award grudgingly given by J&W did not amount to much. But restitution was made, and the money went into the fund that would send Africa Key to Michigan to become a lawyer. He was 17 years old when Wu Chow's auntie made her decision, and the family had practically no spare cash to spend on their living in Hawaii, let alone to send a boy to America. Yet in those important days, Nyuk-tsin started many ventures. She made Asia and Europe, who were already in business, borrow money to pay Africa's ship passage. She sold pineapples and vegetables 6 hours a day, tilled her fields 8 hours,